In this episode of Books and Beer, episode 0, it's so new we haven't even gotten the name right. We never actually intended to release this, but it turned out well, so we did. In this, we talk about fiction, nonfiction, and I Hate on a Visit to the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. Check it out. So welcome to our first podcast of Beer and Books. I'm Greg.
I'm Clarissa.
And we live together and we read books, not together. I don't read over a shoulder or anything, but we read some of the same books, mostly different books, but we're going to try and read the same books. And since we've had some pretty virulent discussions in the past about things we liked about books and didn't like, and sometimes they were the same things, sometimes they were very different. So, yeah, and we got some beer here. I'm drinking a cherry wheat. Sam Adams, and
I have Sam Adams Light,
so I chose the cherry wheat, even though I hate cherries, but I want to try it out because I worked at a winery that sold cherry wine for about a year, or I worked there now for
Well,
a year.
Do you like it? You've taken a few sips now.
I don't know. Let me try it. The thing is that, like, the winery that I worked at had all over-the-top cherry wines. Mm-hmm. Like, they were almost gimmicky to the point where they were not designed to be aged or anything like that. So, that's my sort of point of reference. So, this doesn't really taste cherry to me at all, but it's just mostly beer. But, it tastes okay. I think it's a subtle cherry rather than over-the-top.
Let me try.
Sharing germs. It's been 2 weeks since we saw Contagion, so we can do this.
Yeah, I like it.
So, and I'm not going to try your light because I can tell you right ahead that I'm not going to like it. Despite all the beer commercials telling you that you're not a man if you don't drink the light beer. And also engaging gender norms. So, we're going to talk about books, as promised. Unfortunately, we haven't read the same books recently. I think part of that is because I'm right in the middle of tackling Robert Caro's giant series of biographies about Lyndon Baines Johnson, or LBJ, as he himself wanted to be called. And, for example, the third book, which I'm about to start, is 1,200 pages long. Most of that's a good chunk of that is endnotes. But it's still quite the slog. And these are big pages, too. So,
Well, what if we talked a little bit about, because we've had some interesting discussions in the past about why we're drawn to different, we have very different opinions sometimes on what makes a book good. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, you tend to gravitate towards nonfiction, yeah, generally, and I think you hold it in higher esteem, whereas maybe I'm biased because I'm a fiction writer, but even though I read a lot of nonfiction, I do still tend to hold fiction a little bit higher in my esteem. And I also have found that when it comes to reading novels, you read with a very different critical eye than I do, and a lot of novels that I really enjoy you dismiss as fatuous. And
yeah, I'm kind of a prick when I read novels. It's
but talk to me a little more about what it is you think a successful novel does for you.
Well, that's a tough one. That's one of those big questions of, like, you know, up there with what's the great American novel and that kind of thing. I guess a successful novel for me is it has a certain level of empathy to it, almost. You can feel empathy with the characters, but they can also be pretty disgusting. Like, people... this is a tough question. I guess...
Well, for instance, take Jennifer Egan's book that won... It won the Pulitzer, am I right?
Yeah, it won the Pulitzer.
Yeah. And we both read.
Yes.
And really didn't like it, if
yes.
I remember correctly.
This is A Visit from the Goon Squad.
Yes.
It's her novel of short stories, which actually in... sometimes called... It's a related term called a fix-up that I actually found out recently, is where you've taken a bunch of short stories and sort of woven them together into a novel, either by rewriting them so they have a through line, or doing something else to sort of give it a frame story. It's more common. I think science fiction back in the 60s and 70s had this pretty common because it had a real... That was back when people read short stories in general, but especially science fiction short stories. And so a lot of authors like Asimov and Bradbury would write a bunch of short stories and then tie it together. But Jennifer Egan has not used that word, to my knowledge, to describe her book. She's very adamant about it being seen as a novel, so amongst other things. But I really didn't. It's one of those little trite little books, and it sort of has the same effect that you get. I don't know if any of y'all have ever done this, but if you sit down and you listen to a lot of This American Life, you know, if I used to drive to work 45 minutes there, 45 minutes back, so I'd have lots of time to listen to stuff. And when I discovered This American Life, I listened to a lot of them. And after a while, you just get this overall sense of, like, almost trying too hard to be fables. It's like trite little sort of... There's a little message to each story, and everybody's going to learn something by the end of it. And in the end, we're all going to find out that we're closer to each other than we thought, we're more alike than we thought, and really, pluralism is completely surmountable. And it's just all these little things that, even though I'm probably... Am I the most liberal person you've ever met?
You're up there. I went to college with some pretty liberal people.
Yeah, you went to college at Boston University.
But yes, I'd say you're far to the left of many.
Yeah. I'm pretty out there as far as I don't believe like things like national borders are morally justifiable. And I'm not going to get into that here because that would be a silly discussion. But stuff like that. And this is the kind of thing that really pisses me off because it's people that I should agree with you because we're both inclined towards the same way and like but the way that you're coming to that conclusion that I share with you, the way that you're coming about it is so stupid that you piss me off even more than I would if I disagreed with you. And I mean, I have a pretty high tolerance level for disagreement. I actually I've watched every single Republican debate this year. I think there was one that I didn't catch some of because it was on CNBC and there wasn't an online stream and I didn't have CNBC because nobody really has CNBC. But they didn't have an online stream and I didn't catch it. But every single other one I've watched most of the time in some form of inebriation. I can sit down and watch that, but if I hear stuff that I should agree with that's sort of slanted the same direction as me, but it's pretty stupid, then it pisses me off like none other.
So what you disliked about the book was forum content. I mean, you're being very broad in your criticism of it.
I am being very broad.
And I'm curious as to what it is about it, if you can give any specifics. I know it's been a while since you read the book, but...
Well, it's all sort of... I'm jumping around the fact that basically a lot of these are pretty stock short stories. I mean, they're very finely tuned, and she's clearly an excellent writer, an amazing writer even, I would fairly say. But... The arcs that the characters go through and the lessons learned at the end of the story and the conclusions are like common, like if you took all the short stories that you see in like MFA programs and
I was wondering
else,
how long it would be before you said the word MFA program.
And
you're saying
like
it's not original? It's not particularly original content?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, whenever it comes to short stories, my favorite books of short stories that I've ever read is David Foster Wallace's Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, just because I feel like it took the forms and then it chopped them up and sort of put them back together in ways that still fulfilled a lot of the ways in which older fiction used to work, like J.D. Salinger's Franny and Zoe, which I think is great. And even back to that sort of the Dostoevskian sort of model of grappling with deeply moral issues, but it does that in a completely new way And in a way that sort of shows how sort of full of trite bullshit a lot of other fiction is. That said, I think that there are people who have made very interesting cases that it is simply another form of trite bullshit. And I think we're sort of seeing a wave of that as a bunch of writers on the web try and copy his form, but it comes out as trite bullshit. But I think that Brief Interview with Hideous Men is absolutely amazing. It was written by David Foster Wallace after he got the MacArthur Grant in 97 or so, and he basically worked for the next few years about churning out this amazing collection of stories. The Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, the title story that sort of runs throughout the book, is great, has some really great moments to it. There's some conventional stories like Forever Overhead, about a child going up to a diving board, and sort of it describes everything in sort of lengthened out detail, and it's pretty conventional as far as it goes, but it's absolutely beautiful. And then you've got the completely unconventional stories like Octet, which starts out as a quiz and sort of breaks down over the course of the story. And there are some ones that I don't really get. Like there's one where it's structured like it's told like a Greek myth, but the hit rate is incredibly high, and the stories that hit really hit, and that's what I really love. And that's a fix that you don't get from many authors, but particularly not from Jennifer Egan, because she writes all this trite stuff, and the theme of the story is that time is a goon squad, that time wrecks up our lives. And that's just, I mean, it may be because I'm 25 that I'm like, yeah, I get that, you know, I'm starting to fall apart myself, and you know, I've seen people drift apart as we go from high school to college to after college, even with Facebook to tie us together. But it's not really a theme that I think can drive the story. And I think what finally pissed me off about it is towards the end of the story, she engages in some really bad futurism. Like,
yes, that was one part I didn't care for the last section of the book, when she starts delving into this future world and taking the theme that technology is separating us from each other, yeah, in ways that are strange and unnatural. And the last story of the book specifically did not sit well with me. And yeah, I felt like the continuation of the characters, which was one of the strong points of the book through all of the stories, and the way that she connected them was really strong. And I felt like that sort of evaporated in that last story because the focus was really on the technology and this future world and what would happen to us all.
Yeah. And it's like it's the dumbest possible futurism, which is basically taking what's happening right now and exaggerating it a little and calling that, oh, it's a brilliant satire on today. Like, oh, Twitter, it's facetious now, but in the future, we'll not just be tweeting our breakfast. We'll be tweeting our bowel movements and stuff like that. It's the same sort of shit that you used to hear when Twitter first showed up. And until people clued into, hey, it's a really useful sort of back channel. It's a really useful way to sort of get the ambient sort of noise of something. Sort of the feel of office conversation whenever we're not in offices. I work from home, and Twitter is basically my link sort of where I can, you know, feel if 1,000 voices scream out via the force or whatever. But basically get fed little bite-sized pieces of information where it's not a ton, you know, it's of known quantity and you can sort of parse it out and filter it out easily, but it's just a nice little sort of ambience to the day. But it's that same sort of just bullshit futurism, and that really turned me off and drove me over the edge. And I think I was already pretty steaming, but and then there's like little shit like the fucking PowerPoint channel.
Yes.
That was the first time we've cussed on this podcast, and I think we'll do it a lot.
Yeah, I remember that now. I appreciate that doing something like that is a risk.
Wow. Yeah.
It does not because it's wow, but because it's got to be difficult as a writer to sit down and decide that you're going to tell a story that way. So, and it's got to take it.
But I think that has been thoroughly breached. Like, we've gotten to the web, we've gotten to blogs sort of thing, and I mean, when you're already doing a novel that's made out of short stories, I just don't see it as a risk. I see it as a gimmick. I mean, a gimmick. And I think people treating it as like some revelatory sort of, oh wow, it shouldn't have worked, but it did work because Jennifer Egan is amazing, is sort of completely...
Greg has some very, very strong opinions about his literature.
Well, and I think part of it was that I went into this book, that we picked up this book from the store, I think literally the day or the day after it won the Pulitzer, before they were able to slap this won a Pulitzer stickers on it. So I went into it, I think, with high expectations that were thoroughly crushed and destroyed.
Now, to speak of another book that I believe won the Pulitzer, which is also employs some unconventional narration, but which you agreed with me was absolutely brilliant, was The Known World.
Yes.
Did you know I was going to say that?
Yes, I felt it.
I know what you're going to say.
Unconventional Pulitzer. We both loved it. The Known World.
Yeah, there's not too many books that we both love, actually. Well, yeah. I don't know if that's true, but Greg usually has very... I guess I would say you're not as forgiving as I am when
no.
it comes to judging fiction in particular.
No, there's not... I don't read that many fiction Pulitzer winners. I don't think I... With nonfiction and stuff like that, I will go through and I'll just comb down the lists. But with fiction, I typically read one book by an author and then I'll go read the other books by that author. And it's pretty hard to get me out of my comfort zone with that. So, yeah. But The Known World is pretty... It's amazing. Partially because it completely sort of... I get the trend in books these days is to write them in a very cinematic style. And you can tell the authors that do this because it reads almost like they're writing the screenplay. Like they're setting themselves up. Oh, I'm going to get the movie adaptation of this.
Well, give me an example of what you mean by that, if you can.
I would say authors that write really plainly.
By plainly, do you mean like Jhumpa Lahiri or...
Yeah, I would throw Jhumpa Lahiri, and I would say pretty much every... And I mean, there's a bunch of authors who fit into this mold that are older authors as well. I already brought up Franny and Zoe. So, but I would bring up pretty much every author that seems trapped in almost a steady flow of time, even when they're not describing dialogue. A lot of the authors that do this before movies became the predominant form of pop cultural expression typically did this because they were based on sort of a pattern of dialogue and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But now, even nowadays, you get authors that sort of, even though they're obsessing over detail, the clip of time is still a very steady thing in their books. But there are some authors who completely throw that away and sort of start to realize that there are things that we can do in novels that you can't do in cinema. And one of them is very elegant compression of time and very elegant jumps around in time. And one of the ways that this happens is in The Known World, it'll go sort of tell the books, and it'll be a very oral form of storytelling because the author actually composed it in his head, and it'll sort of hop around. It'll be talking about a scene, and then it'll jump ahead to pull in some detail from 20 years in the future that somehow makes the current scene more poignant. And the overall effect and the intended effect of the book is to sort of realize that all these people are interconnected, and it's done in a much more elegant and much more brilliant way than something like The Goon Squad, which ties them together through a bunch of short stories that sort of has one consistent character between
forces
each.
That connection.
Yeah,
as
forces
opposed
it
to...
and shoves it in your face.
Yes.
As opposed to something that sort of elegantly sort of pulls in threads and gets you to realize that these people are connected not just by space because they're in these scenes, but also by time.
Yes, and the ways at some point grow apart. You realize that you're looking at a tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I think that's the most salient aspect of that book and the most stunning in terms of the way he constructed it.
And it makes it feel so much more like a real history and not just a story, because even though it's based on some historically plausible circumstances, absurd, but still ones that actually sort of did happen in some situations, which was of African Americans owning slaves. And that's the sort of historical perversity that sort of drives the novel. But in the process, he ends up telling all these interconnected stories and pulls in details that almost make it seem not so much like nonfiction, but like something that has really happened, and sort of the story can't be contained to this single through line. It sort of bleeds out around the edges, and these people have real lives that exist beyond the story that he's trying to tell. And so that kind of thing, that book was, I mean, there are lots of other great things that you can tell about that book, just the way that he constructs the characters and everything else, but the really blow your mind aspect of that book is how he'll jump around in time in a way that's decidedly non-cinematic. So I'm starting to burp.
Did you finish your beer already?
No, I'm only halfway done.
Oh, okay. So, I'm getting there.
Yeah, we're about neck and neck, but we're both drink past the necks. So yeah. So that was The Known World is a lot better than A Visit from the Goon Squad, and there's a reason why it won pretty much every single award that a book can win.
I'm surprised I hadn't heard of it before. Yeah. I noticed it on your bookshelf, because that really isn't one of the most wonderful books I've read in years and years of reading, and I don't know why it's not more talked about. I don't ever remember hearing it talked about. I don't ever remember anybody mentioning it. And it's not a difficult read. Like I'm thinking of, you know, a book like Sutri by Cormac McCarthy. That's a very haul read. That took me a very long time to read. But no, The Known World is really a novel in the sense that you can read it and you care about the characters and you want to know what happens and you can plow through it pretty quickly.
And there's some pretty pretty kick you in the gut chapters of just like where you really feel the emotions, and you can feel that the author is sort of turning over, but it's for a good reason, but it's the author is definitely turning over the coals. But it's really fantastic, and I don't know if it's partially because of the subject, I think.
Maybe.
Partially because the author that's his only novel, and he's written one group of short stories and a second group of a book of short stories. And actually, one of the interesting things about his two books of short stories is that in his first collection, each of the stories will connect up to one of the books in the second collection.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually also subtly interconnected as well. So it's sort of like Jennifer, You Can Accept Good. And another reason why you don't hear about it, and you have, not only is the Jennifer Egan book a lot more recent, but Jennifer Egan is in the press a lot. She writes a lot, and she's interviewed a lot, and she gets drug into the stupidest controversies. Like, what was this?
Oh, the million, was it the millions about women writers and nominations?
Yes, yeah. About how, like, there was a book award where
I think it was because she got nominated and Jonathan Franzen didn't.
Yeah,
or something
and there
like
was
that
some,
for Freedom.
And then like Jonathan Franzen's picture got included and hers wasn't or something. And it got turned into some big thing about, oh, you know, she's not as respected as Franzen and that kind of thing. And it's like, well, she won the Pulitzer. And although I think that might have been later, but there's just been a lot of little weird controversies where she's sort of fanned the flames, even if unintentionally, and has been much more of a public figure in a sort of plausible deniability way than is really I'm comfortable.
Edward What's the name of...
Edward Robinson, I think. Is Edward Jones. Edward Jones. Let me check.
We're going to go pull it off the bookshelf. No, it's not on that bookshelf. It's on that bookshelf. We have four bookshelves. Upper right. We have a lot of books. I know where it is. Let me grab it. Lower right.
So Edward P. Jones. So, yeah. And you don't really hear him. I mean, the only thing I've been able to find about him was there was a story in the Washington Post, I think, in a 19 or in 2009 or so, just basically revealing that he doesn't really put pen down to paper and edit and stuff like normal people. He basically writes the books in his heads, and then when he feels that they're done, he'll go ahead and write it down, like he'll type it up or whatever within a few weeks, and that's the book. And he'll just, and then, you know, has this incredible oral memory, and you can sort of feel that the books are sort of made that way.
Well, I think we've sort of covered fiction, and we should maybe touch on nonfiction. Before we call it a night here. So, I guess let's talk a little bit about why it is that you prefer nonfiction to fiction. I don't know, we're mostly talking about you in this, but you have a little bit more...
I have more stronger opinions.
Yeah, you have stronger opinions than I do. I'm pretty malleable. Which may be a bad thing, but
as someone who's trying to get her creative writing MFA in the future, I think you're going to become a lot less malleable once you have to actually sit down. I don't know. You might. I don't know. I'll be interested to see. I guess for context, she's applying to over a dozen grad schools, but they're all going to be pretty selective because they all pay.
Yeah,
basically.
People don't know. It's not really something that's known in the general public, but MFA programs for creative writing, in addition to being a polarizing topic within the community of writers, some writers will say that MFA programs are useless and they just produce a bunch of clones. Other people will say that MFA programs are vital to the development of the writing and literary culture in America. I want to go because it's 3 years fully funded and because it can help you get a teaching degree. But at any rate, people don't know that these MFA programs actually have lower acceptance rates than medical schools, law schools, and top business schools. It's very, very, very difficult to get into an MFA program simply because of the numbers. A program like Iowa, which is probably the highest regarded writing program in the country, gets about 1,500 applications on average for 50 spots. And then some of the smaller programs, for instance, like I applied to North Carolina State. According to the data last year, they got 225 applications for, I believe, 6 spots in both poetry and fiction. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what you're up against, which is why I applied to 18 programs instead of, you know, usually if you're applying to graduate school, you applied to between 3 and 6, I think, for most people. But I applied to 18. So we'll see. I'm waiting to hear at the moment, but it's interesting as a writer living with someone like Greg, who thankfully does not write very much, but who has very, very strong opinions about writing and fiction in particular. But we were talking about nonfiction, so, and I sort of hijacked that conversation by talking about my MFA. But
no, that's good. I think it gives an important context. So, anyways, I think you might end up with stronger opinions after going through that and having to sit through your fellow writers writing and have to deal with the MFA tropes for however long. Because even though they're pretty selective, you should read some of the writing that comes out of these programs. It's pretty...
Well...
I will say, that I like Quiz's writing, and I feel like it avoids a lot of the tropes, and it doesn't drive me crazy, which is probably a good thing, because... we're engaged, so.
Yeah, it would be very difficult to have a first reader who hated everything I wrote.
I don't think she, did you let me read any of your stuff before we got engaged?
Not for a long time, no.
No,
I was very, very nervous.
Luckily, it turned out well, so. I would say that, I mean, part of it has been that There's a lot of stuff that's grappled with in nonfiction that I like that isn't really grappled with in fiction. I'm a big fan of history books, and I mean, a lot of, there is some nonfiction that I read just for the content, but there's also a lot of nonfiction that will hold up as literature. I mentioned earlier that I'm reading Robert Caro's LBJ biography, and it's absolutely amazing. The guy is writing this biography of LBJ. It's going to end up being 5 volumes. He's only done 3 of them. The 4th is coming out actually this May. But they're all beautifully written. He started back in the 70s. So he was able to actually interview a lot of the contemporaries of LBJ, both when he was starting up and all the way to the end of his life. But he went ahead and interviewed all these people, and he started putting out volumes back in 1982 was the first one, then 1990, then 2002, and then 2012 will be the 4th. And the 5th one hopefully won't be long, because Robert Caro is kind of getting up there in age, unfortunately. And he still has one other person he wants to write a biography for, but he's not telling, of course.
I hope it's Queen Elizabeth.
No, it's not gonna, why would it be Queen Elizabeth? Okay, Chris is obsessed with Queen Elizabeth biographies for some reason that's beyond me, because she likes the monarchy.
No, that's not it.
You
it's
don't
not
like the monarchy?
I mean, it's not about the monarchy. It's about her.
You're okay with
a she
family?
She is a fascinating being... woman. It has nothing to do with the monarchy or my opinions about the monarchy. And it has everything to do with her. She's the only person I can think of in the world who actually had a destiny.
A destiny?
Yes. When she was 10 years old and her father became the king, she knew her future. And the question of how someone comes to terms with that and what they decided to do with that, and the fact that she was a figure during the most tumultuous century in history thus far, really has, I mean, it's an interesting question. And what's disappointed me about a lot of the biographies I've read is I don't think they've really grappled with that very much, and that's what fascinates me about Queen Elizabeth.
And yet you still keep on reading these awful biographies who don't grapple with
it. I do order awful biographies. I just finished the one by Sally Bettel Smith, which just came out, and I was a little disappointed because it really didn't go in very deep with the questions that I wanted answered. But it did provide an interesting and more, I guess, congenial portrait of the queen, like what she's like in her private life, and lots of little anecdotes that I hadn't seen before in other biographies. I think this is the 4th or 5th biography of Queen Elizabeth II that I've read, and it was all right, but again, kind of, I suppose, not on the scale of Robert Caro at all, but Greg is snickering at me.
This is like saying, I guess this novel I picked up at the airport was pretty good, but maybe not Vladimir Nabokov. maybe not that. Just throwing it out there.
This isn't really where I would say fuck you, but I shouldn't do that, right? Because we're making a podcast.
You can say that.
Okay.
I think I dropped the F-bomb during a discussion of, like, the known world, which is...
We've really trailed off topic here, sort of.
That's okay. That's what podcasts are for.
I guess so.
For the live conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't, like... And the thing about nonfiction books is that you can build on what you know. Like, they build on each other in a way that you don't really get so much with fiction, unless you're reading, like, fucking fantasy series where there's, like, 10 books or so, and, like, each one, or, like, reading, I don't know, like, more common example would be, like, Harry Potter, where you learn more stories about the backstory of Harry Potter and how his life was a tragedy, but it wasn't. And as it turns out, his family, though, saved him from
Okay,
Voldemort.
Well, we're going to talk about Harry Potter. That should be a whole separate podcast.
Okay, we'll do that at some point. I think I'm overdue for rereading. I was the worst Harry Potter reader ever because I read the first 6 books and then I never read the 7th, and I still haven't read the 7th. So whenever I went to see the 7th movies in theaters, I was... Well, reading the first one, I was bored out of my mind. Because it was some stupid shit. But the second movie was, oh, it was okay. But it's hard to really... Having seen Ralph Fiennes and other things, it's hard
Ray
to really...
Fiennes. It's Ray Fiennes. Damn it, Greg. This is like the eighth time I've corrected you on this.
So anyway, after seeing Ralph Fiennes and other things... Ray Fiennes.
Yes.
Why does he have two names that are hard to do? Like, I can understand having one name that's counterintuitive to name, but like two, really, both of his names? What?
It has nothing to do with books, Greg. Just pronounce the man's name correctly.
God, he's such a weird British person. But,
I don't think he's not British, is he?
Well, I would think he would be. Is he?
We'll have to Google it later.
Right, I'm pretty sure he's British. Like, he's one of those British people that'll sneak up on you, like Stringer Bell.
Okay.
And McNulty. But I'm pretty sure he's British. But anyways, so Ray Fiennes without a nose is hard to take seriously, especially when he has a real problem with sibilant S's. And part of being evil and sort of has slithery hands. Stuff like that. Because, see, Voldemort is like a snake. He talks to snakes and he's very slithery.
What you're criticizing here is the movies.
Also,
you're
he's
not
a
really
little
criticizing
bit,
books.
He's a little bit like Hitler, except he's not Hitler. He's like Magic Hitler. But not like Magic Hitler, because Hitler was sort of into magic.
I'm not
going to
sit here listening to shit all over Harry Potter, Greg.
I'm not shitting over Harry Potter. I'm just shitting over Voldemort. Or he who shall not be named. Ooh, it's telling us a story about whenever people don't talk about things that they're afraid of, it's a bad thing.
You finished your beer, didn't you?
No, I haven't. Yes, I have.
So, should the gimmick of these podcasts be that we talk until we're done with the beer?
Or we talk until I'm drunk and incoherent. Because I finished beers kind of quickly. So, but anyways, nonfiction. Nonfiction I like because you can build on itself. Like, I'm reading these Robert Caro books, but previously I read Before the Storm. I was talking about both of Rick Perlstein's books. Before the Storm is a story about basically the situation that led to Goldwater getting nominated for the GOP, which is amazing, almost unthinkable, but they did it, and then his race against LBJ. It's an amazing book, one of the best history books I've ever read, and I actually like it a little bit better than the follow-up, Nixon Land, which is also excellent. Both of his books sort of managed to capture this sort of pace of events and the feel of events and make you feel like you're back in the day, because he's done a tremendous job of combing through the newspapers and pulling out actual events and keeps you going with the pace and gives you a real sense of the sort of the culture and the social zeitgeist almost of the area. He really captures the zeitgeist better than any other historian that I've ever read.
That's an interesting compliment, because usually that's something that you hear credited to fiction writers as having really captured the spirit of the time about which they're writing, if they're writing about history.
Yeah.
And you assume maybe a little bit with nonfiction writers that they don't have to do that since they're presenting fact, but it's a real mark of artistry when they can do that.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's almost like he accomplishes it through an assault of detail, an assault of events that are happening in the newspaper. Like, there's a really great section, I think it's actually a huge chunk of the book, where he, in Nixonland, he basically... sort of communicates across why a lot of people thought that the world was going to shit and thought that Nixon's sort of law and order status, which was actually code word for oppressed black people, sort of why his law and order stance sort of appealed to a bunch of people. Sort of being able to get that across is very difficult. And he does the same thing in Before the Storm 2 as well. But whereas Nixonland is sort of... That takes over the narrative and almost throws the narrative aside just to go into, like, you know, America was going to hell. And Before the Storm, the overwhelming thread throughout the book is sort of Goldwater coming into sort of power and how these other people were sort of got together and figured out that, hey, Goldwater's our guy. We're going to got to figure out some way to get him elected. And so those books are both excellent. But having read them and reading the LBJ books as well, sort of they tie into each other. This is actually a lot worse example than I thought it was going to be, because I'm reading Means of Ascent, which goes from 1940 to 1948. And this is a book where Kiro actually admits the beginning. He actually goes through and talks about all the things that LBJ accomplished whenever he was in office, both in terms of civil rights and in terms of fighting poverty, but also in terms of escalating the Vietnam War to a point where it was incredible morass that America was stuck in. And sort of saying that, you know, with the good and the bad, were always linked with LBJ, except for during these years in which he was just 8 years of being a complete shithead. And sort of he lays that out, and he's like, this is a point in LBJ's life where for 8 years his ambition took reign and he is not going to accomplish anything. He introduced less than a dozen bills in Congress and passed maybe one or two or something like that, some ridiculous sort of facts about how he basically didn't really accomplish anything in Congress because he wasn't really interested in it. He started his fortune. He made like $1 million by the end of this, which was a lot of money back in the day, and would become millions upon millions as he ascended to the Senate and eventually to the vice presidency and then the presidency itself. And it also talks about, and I'm only halfway through the election, where he ran against Coke Stevenson, and they just finished the primaries. I think this is still a situation time in Texas where the Democratic primary was basically the general election, so to speak. But he ran against Coke Stevenson in the Democratic primary, and they just got to the point where they finished the first round, and nobody has a majority, so there's going to have to be a runoff between him and Coke Stevenson. And so I'm getting to that. And basically, this book is pretty famous for laying out the evidence for the 1948 election having been stolen by LBJ. And that's part of the reason why he wrote it as a separate volume. It was originally just going to be one little chapter in another LBJ book, but it was a big enough deal that he went ahead and broke that out, as well as World War II, into a time just for its own book. And as a result, it's the shortest book out of all, and it's only 600 pages in total.
Only 600?
Well, yeah, but only 400 or so of actual narrative stuff, and the rest is all end notes and that kind of thing. So compared to the next one, which is going to be like 1,200 pages,
mm-hmm.
With end notes, and then the other one, which is like 800, 900 or so with end notes. So it's a pretty slight volume in terms of being part of a 5-volume series. So basically the long story is that I haven't actually caught up to any of the parts that were covered in the other books. So in
you
the Pearlstein's books.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty poor example. But there's a lot of ways in which knowledge gained from other books sort of interleaves and sort of informs your understanding of other books, other nonfiction books. And so that's part of the reason why I think nonfiction books a bit more than fiction, and also because with nonfiction books generally it's a lot less down to personal taste necessarily. There are some nonfiction books that are very artua in terms of they represent a very personal and very specific vision of the world. Like River of Shadows by Rebecca Solnit is fantastic. I mean, I'd recommend it. It's about Edward Muybridge, who invented the moving picture as part of some other stuff. And it sort of talks about how, at the time, compression of time and space was occurring. We were building railroads that were going in between these cities and not literally compressing distance, but the distance you could travel in one day was increasing, and it sort of drew the world almost into a smaller place as a result of it. But while at the same time, these movies were sort of piercing apart the moments, and we didn't really think about what a moment of time was until we had photography that was really fast. The famous example of Edward Muybridge, and one of the reasons why he's credited as the founders of moving pictures, is they took the famous series of a horse to settle a bet between rich people, including the guy he found at Stanford, about whether all four of a horse's legs would be off the ground at any point during the gallop. And it was too fast to see, but using these pictures, he was able to pierce apart the moments of time, and so was able to sort of split apart time itself and allow us to understand it not as one smooth flow, but as a series of moments. And that was something that was really important. I mean, it seems very trivial right now, but that's only evidence for how profoundly the insight has sort of penetrated America, you know, culture at the moment. And sort of starts to give you an idea of why that may not necessarily be a universal sort of view about time. And so it's a really great book. I mean, given the subject, it seems like it is a really slight, but it's really beautiful. It's poetic. I haven't read any other of Rebecca Solnit's stuff because I'm an awful person, but it's really fantastic. And River of Shadows, you should read it. So that's sort of the outlier. A lot of the nonfiction I read is more straightforward. I mean, I'm sort of drawn towards the big grit books and that kind of thing. But it's really more of sort of appeal as data and sort of the force of data sort of making it sort of a conclusion inevitable, I guess. That doesn't really make a ton of sense, but I guess it's what I stick by. So I think we're just about done here.
I finished my beer.
Yeah, and I peed it off. So at some point we're going to talk about a book that we both read recently. Hopefully the next episode.
Yes, we can get into some very spirited debates about books.
But for now, we'll just leave it at this. We've talked for about 45 minutes or so, and that's probably more than anyone needs to hear. So, yeah. See you back soon. This is Books and Beer.
Thanks.